You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We can all spot a children's playground. Chances are it has colored plastic slides and a walking bridge over an area strewn with wood chips. Such playgrounds have been designed for children to have fun, but moreover, to keep them safe while doing it. This playground looks very different. This looks like a junkyard. There are no molded plastic structures, only old tires, some cut in half and filled with mud, rotten old boards, wheelbarrows, rickety ladders. The children over there are pounding nails. You're hammering real nails? Real nails into a board? It's a scene that might terrify parents. So why do researchers studying children's development recommend dropping your child off here unsupervised? Well, to answer that, we might have to remember what it was like to have been a child.
You're hitting it and making it less sturdy.
I'm Molly Bentley at an adventure playground in New York City.
The effort to remove all risk from children's play suggests we've lost sight of why children like to play in the first place, or for that matter, why any species likes to play. It's an important question because play is more than just fun. It has important evolutionary benefits, and we're not the only ones who like to roughhouse, to sled, or to chase a ball. And for listeners who have outgrown recess and playgrounds, when was the last time you felt like you had mindless fun? Find out which of your activities constitutes true play and which don't. I'm Seth Shostak, and this is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute. And as the bard said, the play's the thing. Let's get serious about play.
Adults, play is valuable. Children, it's a necessity.
Yet we keep favoring work over playtime.
It's a huge mistake to think that people are more productive if we keep them at the wheel all the time. That's a mistake we've made in school, taking recess away, taking lunch period away. We think they're going to learn more because of it. They're not learning more because of it. They were just burning them out. And the same thing in the workplace with adults. You need breaks, you need time, you need relaxation, you need time for play and socialization.
As we consider why play is not only fun, but maybe important through adulthood, it's helpful to begin by defining what play is. What constitutes play, and why might it have evolved? There are many amusing examples of non-human animals engaging in behaviors that sure look like play. Okay, Seth, I want to show you this video. So can you just describe what you see in this video?
Well, what I think I'm looking at here is a crow who is sliding down a roof that's partially covered with snow.
Can you tell what he's sliding on? It's the lid to some kind of container.
And, the bird just flipped that lid. And looks like he's going to do it again.
I just think it's remarkable. He is sliding down that roof over and over, carrying the plastic lid up to the top, hopping aboard, and sliding down again.
Okay, that crow sure looked like he was having fun. But how do we know he is actually playing? Or for that matter, how do we know he's actually having fun? I mean, after all, we can't just ask him. When a dog fetches a stick, or rats wrestle, or crows ride plastic lids down snowy roofs, how do we know that what looks like play to us really is play?
David Toomey is professor of English at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and he's the author of Kingdom of Play, What Ball-Bouncing Octopuses, Belly-Flopping Monkeys, and Mud-Sliding Elephants Reveal About Life Itself. Here are the four characteristics that scientists told him distinguish play from other activity. First, play doesn't help an animal stay alive. So the crow sliding down the rooftop isn't doing so to ensure its own survival. Play is voluntary. Three, playing animals have varied movements. Each time the crow slides down the roof, it moves a little differently. By contrast, the movements of an animal pacing back and forth in a cage are not varied. Finally, for the activity to be play activity, it must come from an animal that is well-fed, safe, and rested. Well, with those defining characteristics in mind, our assistant producer, Shannon Geary, asked David Toomey about the behavior of other animals, beginning with her childhood dog, Brooke.
So I had a dog growing up. I had a little wiener dog named Brooke. She was definitely well-fed, well taken care of. So, you know, teaching a dog to, say, sit when offered a treat, or teaching an animal to shake hands when offered a toy, would we consider that play, even though it's kind of training?
There are areas of behavior that may mix play with other things, but when we throw a stick or a ball and the dog chases it and returns it, the dog is likely to be playing with us. What's interesting, though, about that is the dog is also teaching us to play. That is, a dog returns a stick to me, I throw the stick again in a place I want the dog to be able to retrieve it. So, yes, we may be teaching animals to play and training them at the same time, and they may be doing the same to us.
In the study of play, do we have any idea what's happening internally when animals play? Like, do we know what sections of their brain are the most active, or what areas of the brain are connected to play?
There's been quite a bit of research on the neuroscience of play, much of it conducted by Sergio and Vivian Pellis at the University of Lethbridge in Canada. The experiments the Pellises have been conducting over decades now with laboratory rats, it's become clear that neural networks are reinforced by play. We also know from these studies that male rats need play in their youth if they are going to become well-functioning adults. Rats denied play are, let's just say, antisocial or asocial as adults. They are either so aggressive that other rats are afraid to play with them, or they are so timid that they won't play with other rats. So, yes, we do know quite a bit about the neurology of play.
Now, you mentioned some of these studies about rats and play in your book, leading to the title of my favorite chapter, Let's Go Tickle Some Rats, I think it was called. Could you describe for our audience, just give us a picture of what kind of play these rats were engaging with during the experiments where we were tracking neural activity?
Well, rat play is not unlike dog play. That is to say, a rat in the mood to play will try to nuzzle the nape of the neck of another rat. This is, just parenthetically, this is to be distinguished from rat fighting, and it's harsh. It's a knife fight. Play or play fighting is more like a pillow fight. The nape of the neck is the target. That's all. So in a number of experiments, one researcher was curious about the sounds rats were making when they were playing. They were making sounds that were ultrasonic. The researcher needed a bat detector, a machine that can hear the echolocation signals of bats and transfer those into a range that our ears can hear and interpret. He did this with the rats, and it sounds like chirping. And he said it sounded like a playground. So he and his associates began to tickle the rats to see if it would induce more chirping, and indeed it did.
I can't imagine putting rat tickler on my LinkedIn page. And now, do animals like rats that are engaging in this sort of play-fighting behavior, did they ever have the experience that I certainly had with my younger brother growing up, where it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt, you take play-fighting a little bit too far, and then someone is actually injured? How do animals that play-fight recover from something like that?
That's very, very interesting. Animals that play fight, dogs are, I think, the most obvious example, have protocols for it. Two dogs beginning to fight or beginning to play fight agree that they're fighting and tell the other that they're fighting with a rather wide behavioral repertoire. And one movement in the repertoire is the play bow. That is, if I'm a dog and I want you, another dog, to play with me, I will bow my head. I'll bend my forelegs and put my head near the ground, lower than your head is. If you accept that, it's an invitation to play. You accept it, then you will bow your head as low or lower. When that's done, we've agreed we're going to start to play fight. And a play fighting is like the rat fighting. A dog won't try to break the skin. He'll just kind of nibble or nuzzle with his snout. And like rat play fighting, one will momentarily pounce on the other will roll over, and then they'll switch positions. But always they know when they've gone too far, and one goes too far because a dogfight can get pretty frisky and out of hand. If one accidentally bites, he will back off and bow again, and that's as if to say, oops, my bad, sorry, I won't do this again. And if the other one accepts that, as it were, apology, then they will continue to, or they'll return to the fighting, the play fighting, I mean.
So they're playing, but they're also kind of building up relationships with one another. And I think you mentioned this in the book as well, that especially for pack animals like wolves, being able to play and being able to play fight in particular is very important to their survival.
Yes, it is. Wolves, an individual wolf, for instance, cannot take down an elk on its own. It needs others. Thus, if an individual wolf is to survive, it needs others. And a wolf needs to get along with others, to cooperate with others by play fighting. So the play fighting or playing is necessary for the survival of the individual wolf and, of course, for the survival of the pack.
And now, does all play have a survival value to it? Is all play behavior in animals good for some sort of evolutionary reason, or is it just fun?
It may be that fun is necessary for some evolutionary reason. If one wants to put this in the context of evolution, one might ask, why did natural selection make play fun? That is to say, make play desirable. So in answer to the short answer to that question is no one knows, but it does seem that play should have an adaptive advantage. And the reason is that it has so many disadvantages. Play takes time that an animal might better spend doing something else, hunting or mating or foraging. It takes energy that an animal might better spend doing those things. And often it can be dangerous. So all these things would seem to be disadvantageous. So evolutionary biologists don't always know why all animals are playing, but they have reason to think that there is a reason.
You have a really humorous anecdote in your book about these monkeys at the Calgary Zoo who were observed swinging from tree to tree, but then seemingly purposely belly flopping onto the ground, which I have to imagine would have been quite painful. Why would they do this? This seems like a great example of play that has disadvantages.
Well, they were observed by Sergio and Vivian Pellis, and they were quite surprised and a bit befuddled by what was going on. There were three juvenile Pattus monkeys climbing a tree and deliberately falling in the tree, belly flopping on the hard ground. Ouch. And the monkeys getting up from the falls looked as though they were at least momentarily in pain, and yet they did it again and again. One possible explanation would call it the training for the unexpected hypothesis of play. That is to say that play is good training for something you're not prepared for, and good training to recover from something, recovering from a fall. So monkeys are going to fall from trees. It's a given. And in fact, there have been scientists finding monkey skeletons, find that bones are broken in the skeletons quite often. So clearly falling from tree is, at least for tree climbing monkeys, it's part of the deal. But it may be, if you are a tree climbing monkey, a Pattus monkey, you better learn to recover, because you're going to be, sooner or later, you're going to take a fall. So maybe that's what they were doing. So this may be certainly an extreme case, but it could still be explained by the training for the unexpected hypothesis.
When you were researching for this book, what animal play most surprised you?
I think many people expect that playful animals are mammals, maybe birds. I think a lot of people would not assume that reptiles play. A lot of people would not assume that fish play, and yet it seems to be the case. But of the animals that surprised me most, bees.
Bees?
That's right, bees.
Oh, my gosh.
Just last year, some scientists at Queensland University in London did an experiment that tested whether bees could play. And they did this with two chambers, one empty and one filled with bee-sized wooden balls. On one side of these two chambers, these adjacent chambers, were the bees. On the other side was a food source. And the bees, it should be said, had not been fed in a while. They were hungry. They were allowed to choose a path through these chambers. And some went the direct route through the chamber without the wooden balls. A lot of them went, they did not go directly to the food. They stopped to play with the balls, to roll the balls around. And the scientists studying this tried to figure out what was going on. Is this some sort of cleaning behavior? Are they confusing the balls with food? They went through every other list of possibilities, and they finally came up with, no, they are playing. I was surprised by that. It's a recent discovery, and I think a lot of scientists, a lot of animal behaviorists and ethologists would be surprised, because I don't think very many people expected that insects of any kind played.
Finally, why do you think the study of play, and specifically how and why animals play, is so intriguing? What can we learn from this?
I think we can learn what we may know already, but we can be reminded what we may know already, that animals have inner lives, and they may be as rich as our own inner lives. I think we learn that play is more important than perhaps we give it credit for being. It's not too great a leap, I think, to say that life itself is playful.
Oh, I love that. Well, the next time I play fetch with a dog, I'm certainly going to think a lot deeper about it.
Right. Me too.
David Toomey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Toomey is professor of English at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of Kingdom of Play, What Ball-Bouncing Octopuses, Belly-Flopping Monkeys, and Mud-Sliding Elephants Reveal About Life Itself.
Birds do it. Bees do it. Even educated fleas do it.
Well, there's another activity to add to the short list of what birds and bees do. They both play.
Well, indeed, apparently they do.
It's still remarkable to me that bees play. I mean, I think we can accept that dogs play and that wolves play because wolves are the ancestors of dogs, maybe even rats. But insects are a surprise addition to the play group.
And, you know, what that says to me is that play is not some sort of superficial behavior. It must help them to, you know, survive. I mean, it must have evolved because it's beneficial to them getting their genes into the next generation. We've heard that play is fundamental to an animal's development, and that's why researchers are worried that the trend of emphasizing safety in children's play might be depriving them of important experiences. Maybe we've forgotten what it's like to be a kid and what kids are capable of doing.
There's a sturdy metal ladder right here. And
okay, take it sturdy in quotes, yep.
I mean, I would say you're right. It is risky, but honestly, I still have a lot of fun here.
Next, we go to a playground that would be a nightmare for helicopter parents. Find out why risky play is the thing on Big Picture Science.
Watching these children run over loose boards and collect scrap metal that they're putting in a rusted old wheelbarrow in this New York playground, well, it both gives me nostalgia for my unsupervised adventure-seeking childhood and a bit of anxiety in my stomach. Honestly, these rotten old wooden boards, these rusty metal ladders, an old stained mattress, and the other discarded objects that are lying around in the dirt make this look like an abandoned area that should be fenced off with a keep out sign. Of course, that would be catnip for kids, which is precisely the point. And one of the reasons these children are having a blast.
What we do is we take a bunch of these tubes and we just, we kind of just, like, made a tunnel with them.
We'll find out just what these children are getting up to and how that playground is a response to the trend of protecting children at any cost by ensuring that playtime is safe. Some have called it bruise-proofing, but we're learning that these efforts to eliminate risk, dubbed by one child researcher way back in the 1960s as an administrator's heaven and a child's hell, may be detrimental to children's development.
Hi, I'm Mariana Brusoni. I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia in the Faculty of Medicine, and I am a developmental psychologist studying children's outdoor risky play. You know, we didn't used to have a word for risky play. It's really a term that emerged around 2009 was when the first term first came into use. And what did we say before then? Well, we kind of didn't need to, because play was play and risk was a natural part of that.
Mariana, I had a lot of unsupervised play in my childhood. Every weekend and summer day seemed to begin with the bang of the screen door after breakfast and didn't end until the street lamps came on. That seemed to be the norm back then.
Yeah, and you know, and that play memory has some really common themes to, you know, when you ask people to think back to their favorite play memory, it often involves kind of being outdoors, being unsupervised, taking risks, and just kind of making things up as you go along. So yeah, so and what did you think you get out of those kinds of play memories? What did it do for you?
Oh, you're asking me.
I'm asking you, yeah.
It that is a great question. It gave me a sense of confidence because I was nimble and I knew that I could do it, that I could set my mind on a goal and then I could execute it. And this had many parts to it, including like pinching, you know, a little bit of chocolate from the kitchen and then sneaking it back up to my room. It was exhilarating to climb up and down that tree. And it was just fun. I don't know how to describe fun, but it was fun.
Exactly. And so what you're describing is so common about these experiences, right? You can map everything you said onto really important aspects of children's development, health, and well-being. You know, you talked about being able to move your body and gain mastery over your body and understand what it was capable of. That's physical development, physical literacy skills. You talked about kind of building self-confidence in a sense that, I can do this and I'm capable and competent. So that's really important for mental health and well-being. You know, you talked about a sense of joy and fun. Those are really fundamental in terms of also kind of mental health and well-being. So even just your kind of small story and slice of what your childhood was like, you can see the layers of benefit that came from that.
For you, what do you remember from your childhood? Did you engage in some of this risky play?
You know, I'm a child. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. And so very typical of the time I was, you know, leave the house. If we stayed back, we would get stuck into chores. And so it was like, get out of the house as quickly as we could to make sure that we weren't stuck vacuuming or something. And my brothers and I would wander the neighborhood, and we had a river nearby. We would go and catch snakes and, to my mother's lack of delight, bring them back home and kind of wander around at will, for sure.
Well, you know, Mariana, when you describe going to the river and catching snakes, and then you imagine me up on a roof, this is something that our parents might have blanched at back then, but certainly today, these would be no-nos for children, I think, growing up in today's ultra-safe environment. Can you give us an overview in what ways we have limited such risky play for children? What is the new ethos?
Yeah, well, and it's a not so new ethos, because the change started happening in the late 80s. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But one of the things that we kind of point to is a change in parenting approach, right? And so this sense that they really had to curate their children's lives to make sure that they were in activities that were enriching their brains and so that they would get into kind of the right schools and into the right universities and so on. And so then it just became, play was seen as a waste of time. At the same time, we had a diminishing sense of children's competence, that they really needed adults to kind of control their lives and tell them what to do. And so the feeling that being a good parent was not only making sure your kids' brains were, you know, kind of developing in ideal ways, but also making sure that they were always supervised and in controlled activities so that they were, you know, what was perceived as safe.
Well, in some way, and you could describe for us, that translated into a change in playgrounds, for example. Now, I grew up playing on monkey bars at pretty questionable heights, high heights, and jumping on those playground spinners that would go round where all the kids would pile on and they'd grab onto a bar for dear life because they didn't want to go flying off onto the gravel. And those play structures seem to have been replaced by what's called safety playgrounds, playgrounds with plastic slides, with soft contours and structures that seem to limit a child's access to great heights or speeds. You can see the appeal for parents with these playgrounds.
Yeah. So the approach you're talking about is like let's make kids as safe as possible, rather than as safe as necessary, which is what we're going towards now. So as safe as possible means let's prevent everything. And so the playgrounds that developed, you know, from that thinking, as you identified, they're much lower in height. There's surfacing underneath that's meant to be soft surfacing. They're much more uniform. And, you know, generally they come out of a catalog and they all look the same. And there's very few what we call affordances for play. And so when we think about that, you know, some of the best things that provide high affordance are things that you can move around or natural materials. So like sticks, rocks, mud, tarps, crates.
In your case, snakes.
Snakes, exactly, yes. Yes. So things that kids could move around to allow their imagination to shape the play.
And we're going to talk about what the antidote to this has been. But Mariana, what have doctors and researchers noticed about children that suggested there was a problem? And what sort of evidence backs that up?
Right, yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, we needed a term for what was missing. And that's hence the term risky play. And that allowed us to do a whole bunch of research around what was missing. You know, and that's where I come back to your favorite childhood play memory. So what we've been able to show is that kids who have less of these experiences are impacted in terms of these other aspects of their health and development. So we do see really robust findings around, you know, kids being less physically active and moving their bodies less, you know, being more sedentary, being more interested in engaging with friends, you know, online through screens, because that's more thrilling and exciting than what they're actually seeing outdoors. And we have this really interesting research around mental health impacts of this. For example, research showing that teens and young adults who had overprotective parents are more likely to be anxious and depressed. There's a challenge with self-confidence and feeling that they can manage things, you know, a kind of a sense of that the world and the uncertainties are too hard to handle. And so they tend to pull away from them rather than leaning in. And on and on and on. The research is building and building and building around what kids are missing if they're missing this kind of play.
Well, one of the responses to the culture of caution has been the construction of adventure playgrounds like this one here on Governor's Island in New York called The Yard. It has risk built into every rickety structure, rotting board, and rusting bit of metal. There are no soft molded plastic slides or soft surfaces to cushion you if you fall. It's basically a junkyard. Kids are allowed inside. The parents are not. There is one rule: closed-toed shoes are required. Otherwise, the children make up the rules. There's a child just hitting a board with a stick really hard. There are rotten old boards, a whole pile of them here. Talk about Splinter City. Old ladders, some of them are rusted. The metal ones are rusted. The wooden ones look pretty rickety. It looks like one child here has found a piano, old piano. One child is just going by on a scooter there. It looks like a scooter from about 50 years ago.
Adventure playgrounds really grew out of post-World War Europe, right? So you had all of these kind of bombed out building sites within cities, like London and others, and the kids started playing in them. And so there was a realization at the time, Lady Ellen of Hartwood was one of the people that really supported this, in terms of recognizing the incredible play opportunities that they offered, particularly for kids who had just come through a war and just needed the psychologically soothing aspect of play and how important play is for being able to manage, you know, trauma and those strong emotions and so on.
But one would imagine that these, you know, makeshift playgrounds would have broken glass in them and bricks, and just sounds like they would be actually quite dangerous places for children.
Yep, absolutely. And you should see some of the pictures coming out of them. They would be hair-raising to today's parents. But it started a whole lineage of the idea of adventure playgrounds, where you dedicated space in neighborhoods for what were essentially junkyards where kids could hang out.
And we have over here a huge bit of corrugated plastic drain pipe, big enough for an adult to crawl through, and of course a child with no problem. Hi, are you Jake?
Yes.
It's nice to meet you, Jake.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
How old are you, Jake?
I am 11.
What's your favorite thing to do here at the yard?
Talk and play with my friends. And I love to explore, because every time I come, there's always something new.
Mm-hmm. Can you just give me a little tour here and just tell me what you see?
All around the yard, there are a bunch of wood piles. There's a mud pit.
Mud pit. Are you worried about getting splinters there in that wood pile?
Not really. I've never thought about that. We have the Sky Fort, which is probably the tallest structure here.
The Sky Fort.
Yeah. Usually, right here, there would be a mattress. And then up on that platform, like, you'd stand on that platform and then you would jump down onto the mattress.
So you're telling me that you jump from up there?
I'm pretty sure it's 10 feet. I have never done it. That pushes my limits.
I'm Yoni Kalai, the interim director and one of the co-founders of Playground NYC.
Well, and Yoni, you're one of the few adults that is allowed to go into the yard. That's a privileged position, as I understand. The parents aren't allowed in here.
That's right. We keep the parents out of the playground because we find that they try to control too much and not let them even get a little bit of mud on their shoes or their clothing. All sorts of things that they try to stop.
Guys, this is going to be a very shady house.
It's going to be a shady house?
Yes.
Yeah. You're hammering real nails? Real nails into a board?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Here's one.
There's a nail. Yep, that is a nail. Where did you find that? Was that on the ground?
Oh, no. There's a bunch of them on there. Yeah.
The kids, just like you see the risk, the danger, they see it just as much as you do. And they don't want to get hurt. Nobody wants to get hurt.
To get up, there's a sturdy metal ladder right here. And
okay, taking it sturdy in quotes, yep.
I mean, it doesn't look sturdy, but up top, like, I have tried to test it to see if it'll fall down. This won't fall down. I mean, it's been here for a long time, but down here it's not really connected to anything because, you know, there's like dirt on the ground. But up there it's tied, and I don't know. It kind of feels like it's welded in, but I don't think it is.
So to be clear, Marianne, while adventure playgrounds have been around for a long time, this is a recent intentional step to build these playgrounds, especially in urban areas, so that children can engage in risky, unsupervised play. This is a trend.
Well, it was a trend before, and it was in the 80s that they started shutting them down. And they're only now kind of coming back into fashion as we're realizing how important they are.
What strikes me is that as soon as they walked into the yard, we came over on the ferry with them, they just scattered and then just got into it, right? They grabbed something, they grabbed a wheelbarrow, they grabbed a tire or something or a stick, and they just started to play right away.
Yeah, kids are the experts of play, and we as play workers are just trying to support their play.
She's splashing water all over herself from this bucket. Does that feel good?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, my gosh.
Hug?
Oh, hug? Yeah, I'll hug you. Thank you for that wet hug. Oh, my goodness. This is so fun. Well, among the groups that are recommending that we bring risky play back is the Canadian Pediatric Society, that is Canada's National Association of Pediatricians. They recently released a statement on the importance of risky play for children. And how does that translate into practical recommendations? What are they suggesting that parents do?
Yeah, I mean, it's super exciting that the Canadian Pediatric Society has come out with this statement. It's a very powerful statement to make. Essentially, what they've said is that they've urged their pediatrician members to add risky play to their clinical toolbox as a way of managing some of the major issues that they're seeing in their offices today. Things like obesity, anxiety, and behavioral problems.
You're testing out your strength? Whoa. What is that?
It's a giant ball. What's that?
This is a recorder. I don't think that's a ball. I think that's a like an old like oil drum. I think I saw as one of the rules for this new era of risky play is bruising is okay, but not bleeding.
it really, you know, people have different tolerance for their risk level. We actually did a study, some colleagues of mine, around what do we consider as a serious injury. They polled surgeons and medical professionals from across different aspects of the medicine to see what do they consider a serious injury. So things like broken arms and legs and even like stitches and all that were not considered serious injuries because it's like those can be fixed, you know, and the kids will recuperate from those. And to, as I said before, to take an as safe as possible approach where you're trying to eliminate all of that stuff, you need to think about the cost involved in not allowing kids to do these things, right? Like, it, you know, one example is that the monkey bars in playgrounds, they're where most of the broken arms and things happen. So is the solution to get rid of monkey bars? Okay, well, where are kids supposed to build their upper body strength? Where are they supposed to get that kind of swinging sensation that's so beneficial to all aspects of kind of their joy and fun, right? So like we need to balance, right? And that's where we're really going for an as safe as necessary approach, where we're trying to control the most serious hazards and those that could lead to really serious injury and death, but leave the risks intact so kids can make a decision for themselves.
Okay, so let's say that you were climbing one of these ladders and it feels kind of shaky, or, you know, you're starting to lose your balance on something. What do you do next? Like, how do you manage those kinds of risks? Because there are no adults, you know, your parents aren't here.
Yeah, so that is something that is different about the junkyard is there aren't really grown-ups allowed. And honestly, let's say I'm on a ladder and it starts to feel like it starts to feel shaky, like that ladder, yeah. Like the ladder to up to the sky fort. What I would do is, if I was, like, I would check of which half I am. If I'm closer to the top of the sky fort, I would just keep going a little faster. But if I was closer to the bottom, then I would go down.
One downside of an adventure playground like this is that it does require a lot of space. This is much bigger than, you know, say the playground you'd find at a park or play structure. You would need more staff to maintain this. And there is a chance that kids will get hurt. So there are a few downsides to this kind of a playground.
I want to first address the part of getting hurt. Kids get hurt on normal playgrounds all the time. When you're a, let's say, 9-year-old who's been to your neighborhood playground for years, and it's always the same, you've done it a million times, it's not interesting anymore, you start using it in ways that the equipment has not been intended to be used, and nobody's supervising. And now you're jumping onto a rubberized surface, which you think absorbs the shock, but when you're jumping from 12 feet, 15 feet, is not going to do anything for you. So our rate of injury is not anything more than regular playgrounds. There's a study that was done at the Adventure Playground in Houston where they have a normal playground and an adventure playground on the school, and they found that the rate of injuries at the normal playground was actually higher. And as far as staff, yes, I think that it's better to pay people and not spend millions of dollars on play equipment when we repurpose all the materials instead of it going into the waste stream. Kids love to play with it. It's every time different. They get to change things. It's junk, so nobody feels precious about it. If it gets broken, it's fine.
You're going to relax now?
Uh-huh.
How much hammering do you think you did?
I did two nails.
Hey, Daddy,
you did two nails.
A long time to do anyways, since they're like this long, yeah, so then you have to hammer them in for a
just for reference, that's about 4 inches, yeah.
But what we see in the research is that kids are, you know, they're hanging out with each other. They're figuring out how to do things. There's not an adult telling them what to do. Things are going wrong and they're managing it. Things are going right and they're building self-confidence around that.
And what are you guys building here?
Yeah, we're just building shade.
You're building shade. That's very smart because today is a very sunny day and it's supposed to get up to 80 degrees. I'm walking with the children back to the ferry to go back into Manhattan. They've all had a great time. Many of them are soaked wet because they figured out how to open up a hydrant, a fire hydrant there at the end. It feels pretty good, huh?
It does. It's really hot.
Did you guys have fun today?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. A scale of 1 to 10 of fun, how much fun did you have?
10.
Well, the joys of youth. Thanks to Mariana Brusoni, a developmental psychologist and professor at the University of British Columbia in the Faculty of Medicine.
Thanks also to Yoni Kalai, the interim director and one of the co-founders of Playground NYC, for allowing access to the playground, and to Jake's parents for granting us permission to talk with him, and to Jake for providing a fantastic tour of the yard.
Next, the evolutionary benefits of play for humans and how to address what some say adults are suffering from, a surfeit of somberness.
We all are playful inside. We just have to let it out a little bit.
That's because the play's the thing on Big Picture Science.
Well, those kids were having a blast at the playground, and I might add, so were the adults who were there that day. But frequently it's more the case that adults grow out of the urge to play, sadly, just like some animals, as we heard earlier in the show.
And some researchers lament the loss of play as we get older.
I'm Peter Gray. I'm a research professor of psychology and neuroscience at Boston College. I am very interested in the role of play in human evolution and as well as in the role of play in human development.
Dr. Gray joins other researchers who say our lack of lightheartedness and the dearth of downtime amounts to a public health crisis. But no worries, he has tips for how to recapture your inner child.
It is a health crisis, I believe, for adults, although my case has always been about how it's a health crisis for children. Adults, play is valuable. Children, it's a necessity. And we take play away from children and they're obviously suffering. Now, given that, I will turn to adults. First of all, we are a very sedentary society, largely. And so one of the health problems is that we're indoors all the time and we're doing sedentary things with our work. And because we're doing sedentary things with our work, we're not getting physical exercise, we're not breathing the fresh air outdoors, which is all very healthy.
It makes me wonder if workplaces should factor in time for recess, like the way we had it in school.
Right. Certainly so, I think. And at least for lunch hour, I mean, which has been taken away from a lot of, you know, I hear from people in the workplace where they're expected to eat their lunch while they're still on their computers doing their work. You know, It used to be you'd have an hour, which was kind of play. You'd go out to lunch with your friends and colleagues. You'd talk about things. You'd socialize. You'd make fun of the boss. You'd do all these things. And you come back more productive. It's a huge mistake to think that people are more productive if we keep them at the wheel all the time. That's a mistake we've made in school, taking recess away, taking lunch period away. We think they're going to learn more because of it. They're not learning more because of it. They were just burning them out. And the same thing in the workplace with adults. I was once asked to give a talk to a group of elderly people about the value of exercise, actually, was the topic. And I said, I titled the talk, Don't Work Out, Play Out. Any kind of physical activity that is really fun, that is play for you because it's fun, because it's something you are doing because you enjoy it, is going to keep you physically fit.
But I wonder, Peter, then, does all play include vigorous exercise outdoors? I mean, what about playing cards? Hard to get your heart rate up playing cards, but I guess if you have a really good hand, you maybe.
So let me tell you another thing. There's a lot of research, actually, that shows that playing video games is a great thing as you get older, that it forestalls, there's actually research, it forestalls the memory loss, it forestalls, there's evidence that it's a good protection against Alzheimer's, that video games are extraordinarily mental play, mental exercise. They exercise the very kinds of abilities we tend to lose in older age. Now, that would be true for other kinds of games, too. It's true for all kinds of games that involve thinking, that involve planning, that involve memory and tension. You know, people who play cards, you know, when my parents' generation, every time people got together, they'd play Canasta, which is a game that involves a certain amount of luck, but there's also a certain amount of skill and thinking, and there's social part of it that's involved.
One other definitional question is, do you distinguish between leisure time activities and play? So reading a book or watching a movie, that can be very relaxing for people. I don't know if we would call that play. Practicing the piano, which also, you know, requires some discipline. It is literally playing the piano, but is that considered play? So, you know, we lose track of this as adults. How do we know what is play and what isn't, and when we're engaging in it?
I'm glad you asked that, because I think play, like a lot of words, has a lot of different meanings in the English language. So my definition of play is that play is an activity that has these four characteristics. The first characteristic, and maybe the most important one, is it's self-chosen and self-directed. It's something that the player or players themselves have decided to do, and they've decided how to do it. When children are playing, they're mostly making up the rules, but and when groups are playing, they have to negotiate how they're going to play. So that's the first part of the death. The second characteristic of play is it's intrinsically motivating. You are doing it for its own sake. You're not doing it for some reward outside of itself. You're not doing it for money. You're not doing it for gold stars, for an A on a report card. You're not doing it to improve your resume. You're doing it really because you want to do it. Now, that doesn't mean it couldn't have valuable other effects, but to the degree that you're doing it for those outside things instead of because you want to do it, to that degree, it's not play. So just to make a point about this aspect of it, if you have a job that you think, I would do this even if I didn't need the money, it's quite legitimate to say that job is play. So I want to make it clear, because this is part of adult play and work are not necessarily incompatible. So the third characteristic of play is that play is always structured. Play is never random activity. Play is organized activity where you and your playmates are organizing it yourselves, or you're following a pre-planned organization that you have chosen to follow. And the fourth characteristic of play, and this is a valuable characteristic for adults as well as children, is that play is always creative. Children's play is almost always imaginative. Much of adults' play is imaginative, but it's always creative. So although the activity is a structured activity, there's a lot of room always for creativity. So play exercises your creativity.
As you describe that, I wonder if cooking is a kind of play. I know people and I can get in the mood for cooking certain things that is great fun and it feels creative. Now, it's very structured unless you don't care what goes into that cake, but it does feel both like play, like back to the sandbox or something like that, because you are sifting through the same kind of material if you're baking, and leisure. You know, it doesn't feel like work always.
So I think the point here is that play is never defined by what kind of activity it is. It could be cooking, it could be pounding nails, it could be anything. It's defined by the attitude that you have about it. So for some people, cooking is anything but play. For other people, it is definitely play. And for the same person, it might be play one day and definitely not play another day. So play doesn't have to do with the kind of activity. It has to do with the attitude and the motivation that underlies that activity.
Well, let's look at the big picture and the evolutionary origins of play and where the impulse arises in the brain, because it's my understanding that scientists have discovered that the drive to play originates in the brainstem, which in evolutionary terms is one of the oldest parts of the nervous system, which suggests that play has been around for a long time and maybe has survival value.
Play has definitely been around for a long time and without question has survival value. How long it's been around is debatable. So yes, play has been around for a long time. The primary function, and this is why play is especially important for children and for juvenile animals, is to practice the skills that are required to grow into adulthood. So animals of all species play at the activities that are really important for them to develop. And I've made the case this is definitely true for human beings too, and especially when I look at hunter-gatherer cultures and how the children play.
Could you just give an example there, please?
So let me give an example for humans. So one thing people have to learn everywhere is how to use human language. Children play at language. They learn language in play. They don't learn language by being taught it. They learn it in play, and I've documented that. One other thing is it's really important is to learn how to get along with other people. This is extraordinarily important. We are a social species. Children learn how to get along with other children by playing with them. They learn how to compromise, how to negotiate, how to accept being teased a little bit, how all of these social skills, how to make friends. So these are very general things, but even beyond that, when you look at any given culture, what you find is that the children, they play in ways that promote all of these things I just described, but the specific activities they choose are very often activities that are really important to their culture. So when I looked at hunter-gatherer cultures, the kids play with digging sticks, with bows and arrows, they play at hunting, they play at tracking game, they play with dugout canoes. When we look at farming cultures, kids play with farming instruments. What do kids play with today? They play with computers. Without question, the most important tool of our culture today. So of course they are drawn to computers. So kids not only play in these ways that promote the things that you have to learn everywhere, but they also play at the specific things that they can see are important to the culture that they're growing up in.
That is fascinating. So the play reflects the values of the culture or of the society.
Let me tell you another evolutionary function of play: promote cooperation. So what's interesting about hunter-gatherer cultures is that they absolutely depend in a way that's much more immediate even than for our culture on cooperation and sharing. They can't survive without sharing all the time. So when you are in a situation where you need to share and you need to cooperate, you need to be in a situation where you really trust one another. And I'm convinced that the reason we see such high levels of playfulness and play of all sorts among adult hunter-gatherers as well as children is because they have developed over time, they have learned, if you will, that by playing, by having a playful attitude, we keep a good attitude towards one another. We all are playful inside. We just have to let it out a little bit.
Peter Gray, thank you so much for encouraging us all to be a little bit more playful.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Peter Gray is a research professor of psychology and neuroscience at Boston College.
Well, Seth, that brings us to the big picture perspective in the show. And what are some takeaways from you on the subject of play?
Well, I guess it's just my opinion that any behavior that we indulge in, you know, as kids, has, developed because of the evolutionary pressures to do so. In other words, it has survival value to play. Okay. And I think we've seen that over and over again in this show. And it's also fun, but that's part of the attraction. It's part of why we do it. It's fun. Ask kids why they play, and that's what they'll tell you. They won't say, well, it helps me to develop skills and behaviors that will be useful for me when I'm an adult.
Indeed, I think David Toomey was the one who said, if we weren't meant to play, then why did natural selection make play so much fun? Well, this show would not be possible without the creative and playful work attitudes of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that studies life in all its complexity. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also, a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. And there's one more thing.
This episode of Big Picture Science that looks at the science of why humans and other animals like to do things like run, jump, climb, and bounce balls is called The Plays the Thing.
Perfect. Bravo.
Okay. Thank you.